Fincher's sexual misconduct, and appointed him to a powerful position still. Within days, the man nicknamed the Great Political Survivor was forced to throw in the towel. Saeed Pariza, London.
Tehran, the capital of Iran, and now a destination for investors. Tehran Investment Summit brought together businesses, mayors, and urban development officials from Iran and the world to explore areas of investment in Tehran.
It's so important for us to participate in here, and we consider as a not only for a relationship between two cities, it's in the, including for the relationship between two countries.
2 years ago, the Iranian and Nicaraguan capitals, Tehran and Managua, signed an MOU that named them as sister cities. Now, with the Tehran Investment Summit, there is a chance for Managua to further cooperate with Tehran in launching urban development projects.
210 projects covering waste management, transport, and tourism, among others, will be introduced to investors in the two-day conference. The projects total roughly $71 billion. Tehran municipality says if those projects are accomplished, they will revolutionize the Iranian capital.
This is the start of a turning point in Tehran's development. This conference was inaugurated today, but it has no closing ceremony. The exhibition section of the event will continue to run permanently to highlight any area that needs investment. This will transform Tehran's future.
Being among the busiest cities means that Tehran is inevitably among the most polluted places in the world. Municipal authorities say they also welcome any investment in controlling air pollution in Tehran.
Eliminating air pollution and traffic congestions are among the major challenges in Tehran, which can be solved permanently through the promotion of clean transportation. I'm certain that many investors would love to invest in this area.
Attracting foreign investment has long been a challenge for Iran as a result of U.S. sanctions that restrict global banking transactions with Iran.
I would not say that sanctions will not affect foreign investment, but we are focusing on the private sector, which acts separately from governments. Meanwhile, the Central Bank of Iran has also promised to support foreign investors should they take part in Tehran's development projects.
Life in the Iranian capital is a mixed experience of modernity and antiquity, as it's home to both skyscrapers and historic buildings, together making it a hot tourist target. But tourism is only one of the countless capacities for investment in Tehran, as it's home to some 15 million residents, and with a large population comes a wide array of interests and businesses. As the capital of Iran, Tehran has numerous opportunities for investors, from tourism to transport and pollution control projects. Many of those projects have so far been running based on citizen participation or tax revenues. Now, Tehran municipality says with its approach shifting toward investment, the development of the metropolis is expected to accelerate. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
What was meant to be a routine weekly gathering of cabinet ministers morphed into something very different. Double mortal blows to the Prime Minister Boris Johnson as his Health Secretary Sajid Javid and Chancellor Rishi Sunak quit their jobs within minutes of each other, handing in resignation letters that make for extraordinary reading. The vote of confidence last month, Sajid Javid wrote, was a moment for humility, grip, and new direction. I regret to say, however, that it is clear to me that the situation will not change under your leadership, and you have therefore lost my confidence too. The Chancellor also took aim at the PM's character. The public, he wrote, rightly expect government to be conducted properly, competently, and seriously.
Nothing's worse for a party than a loss of faith in the character of their leader. And these senior politicians, and let's recognize over a dozen of them have now resigned, are saying it's either Boris Johnson or us. Since Boris Johnson isn't going, they are. They're going to have to sit it out, like Boris, but there can only be one winner, and it won't be the Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson's is a government embroiled in sleaze and scandal for months, from lockdown rules-breaching parties under his roof to porn-watching MP. The latest controversy emerged over this man, Chris Pincher, forced to resign from government over accusations of sexual harassment. But the last straw was when it turned out that despite Number 10's denials, the Prime Minister knew of a past formal complaint against Pincher all along. He appointed him to his cabinet.
I apologize for it. I think in hindsight it was the wrong thing to do. I apologize to everybody who's been badly affected by it.
But that didn't wash with the now former Chancellor and Health Secretary or the dozens of MPs who have already resigned. More defections could be on the way.
There's no doubt that we will see more resignations, with quite a few cabinet ministers not declaring one way or the other. But the realpolitik here is he's lost the confidence of his party. He's lost the confidence of a very large number of people whom he himself appointed, and the public aren't taking him seriously. Like Boris as a friend, I think he's a decent man. But the one thing he doesn't seem to have is good judgment about when to leave.
Whether or not Boris Johnson can survive politically is a question debated by his friends and foes for months. The question now is whether these recent resignations will be the beginning of the end for a prime minister whose leadership is in free fall and as the specter of a new no-confidence vote looms large. Saipur is up, London.
Iran's embassy in Lebanon held a ceremony to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the abduction of four Iranian nationals in Lebanon. Iranian ambassador to Lebanon lauded the four men as messengers of peace to Lebanon, noting that Israel was behind their abduction.
We are pursuing the case of our four diplomats via diplomatic and legal means, as their fate is very important for us. This ceremony is being held to honor and remember our diplomats, and it helps us shed light on the fate of our kidnapped diplomats. We have repeatedly said that we have documents and evidence showing our diplomats were handed over to the Israeli regime following their abduction. Israel is politically and legally held accountable for their abduction. We will pursue their case until their fate is known.
A military attaché at Tehran's embassy in Beirut, Ahmad Mutavassilian, along with Iranian charge d'affaires in Lebanon, Mohsen Mousavi, an employee of the embassy, Taqir Asdiqar Muqaddam, and a photographer for the Islamic Republic agency, Qasim Akhavan, were abducted on July 4, 1982. Lebanese militiamen from the Lebanese Forces Group admitted to kidnapping the four men who were on a diplomatic mission in North Lebanon. Investigations show that they were last handed over to Israel at the time.
The legal follow-up of this case in the last few years proves without a doubt that these men were kidnapped on a militia checkpoint, and it was proven that they were put in the jails of that well-known militia which was collaborating with the occupation entity. There are testimonies that they were handled over to the occupation forces. The Lebanese government has a responsibility to follow up the case to highest levels, including the International Criminal Court.
Those in attendance called for an objective investigation by the United Nations and the International Red Cross. Although there is information about those who abducted the Iranian diplomats and their whereabouts, the fate of these Iranians remains shrouded in mystery. The families and Iranian officials believe they remain detained in Israeli jails. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
British Indians flocked to central London Sunday to condemn India's ruling government over its failures to protect Indian minorities from persecution. The anger comes after a string of incidents saw huge numbers of India's 204 million Muslims turn against the authorities, which Muslims claim are systematically discriminating against them.
Violence and discriminatory rhetoric against minorities in India has become so commonplace that many onlookers fear that a genocide may be on the horizon. Muslims in particular are fearful, given that Islamophobic hate crimes have run rampant in India.
Accusations against New Delhi include allowing sectarian attacks on mosques, failing to stop anti-Muslim lynch mobs, hijab bans, and the bulldozing of homes in Muslim areas, essentially a type of ethnic cleansing.
What's happened to minorities in India, if you don't know, is it is on the brink of genocide. This peaceful demonstration is not against India. I want to repeat, it's not against India, it's against the government of India. They are not doing anything, they are complacent. They are basically wanting to make India into into a Hindu Rashtra, I move away from democracy.
I think that it's wrong that there should be hijab bans. It's wrong that people should be persecuted for interfaith relationships. It's wrong that Indian Muslim homes are bulldozed. And it's wrong, as we saw with Indian farmers, that there's state sanction, sedition and suppression of rights and views and peaceful protests.
India's Prime Minister, who heads the ruling BJP party, has been accused of pushing an extremist Hindu nationalism, which preaches intolerance of other religious groups. Under Narendra Modi's watch, India has been routinely condemned by human rights groups over anti-Muslim discrimination, but the attention of Western leaders has been more focused on building trade with India to help combat economic instability. And that is why, so far, concerns by Muslims in India have fallen mostly on deaf ears. Robert Carter, London.
Donetsk is on fire. The Ukrainian army has been bombing civilian areas of this city for 3 straight days. We travelled to one of the areas hit yesterday and this morning. Markets are common targets for the Ukrainians, presumably because they are more likely to kill, and in the hope of breaking the will of the Donbass people who support Russia.
How can they kill civilians? It's awful. What are they doing? What purpose are they doing it for? We didn't do anything to them. We need peace. We need to work, to raise our children. Terrible things are going on. We have to sit in the basements without food or water. We need peace.
Now, our driver has just told us to hurry up. Indeed, one of the women we interviewed also told us afterwards to get out of here quickly, as there could be more incoming. Now, while it's quiet at the moment in Donetsk, frankly, you can be hit anywhere at any time. The hotel behind the market is still on fire. It was hit this morning. Locals tell me the same place is often bombed hours later in the hope of killing those who come to inspect the damage. A piece of deadly shrapnel lies on the road. Now, I've just entered a residential area just adjacent to the market. We've heard that there were a couple of people killed here earlier. A shell pounding the apartments with shrapnel. A woman and her children appear at the window. She tells me it hit a couple of hours ago. Shrapnel smashed through her window. Now, we've just seen people running for shelter. We've just sheltered down ourselves as they've been incoming here. We heard the explosion a little bit, we're way off. But this area is still very dangerous. We strikes any time. Now we were going to try and find the woman, the 2 people killed, the relatives of them, but frankly my team has said we've got to get out of here as it's just too dangerous. At the market, the anger amongst people is palpable. The women I speak to are visibly angry at me for being British.
You're scoundrels, those who kill civilians, children. More than 200 people have been killed in Donetsk these previous months, not to mention those wounded. So many children have died. It's outrageous. There's no forgiveness for this. They're killers. They're murdering ordinary people for the sake of their own interest. Why don't you look after your own country? All the best to you. What shall I tell my child? That I have no money and we have nothing to eat? That everything was sheltered here? What have you come here for? Do you give me any money? I have to provide for my child and live somehow. And where do I earn money now? I've been working here for 20 years. 20 years. And it's all over now.
Scenes like this are played out across the city every day now, as Western governments and media focus on alleged Russian war crimes. In Donetsk, Ukraine is getting away with murder. The guns and ammunition for these attacks are increasingly being paid by taxpayers in NATO countries. 3 were killed yesterday, 5 the day before, and already today, a 10-year-old girl has been killed. Under the almost constant crash of new explosions, civilians are being slaughtered every day. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message on the occasion of the annual Hajj pilgrimage, calling for unity among Muslims in the face of plots to create divisions in the Islamic world. The leader said, enemies have long strived to sow division and undermine spirituality among Muslims. Ayatollah Khamenei, however, said the Islamic world is today ready to foil such plots. He also hailed what he called the stability, independence, progress, and honor of the Islamic Republic of Iran as a meaningful phenomenon that can attract the thoughts of every conscious Muslim. 1 million Muslims, mostly from outside Saudi Arabia, are taking part in this year's Hajj pilgrimage. That's the biggest since the start of the COVID pandemic. Joining us on Spotlight, we have journalist and political commentator Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, joining us from the British capital, London. And from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Chajid, who's also joining us from the British capital.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas in London. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has issued a message on the annual event of the Hajj pilgrimage calling for unity among Muslims. Talk to us about the significance of the Hajj pilgrimage and with it the importance of Islamic unity.
Well, of course, the aspect of Hajj, which everybody's very familiar with, is this kind of devotion and submission to the divine. It's almost like an oath of allegiance that one goes back and replenishes. And of course, there's that whole spiritual element of seeking forgiveness from the divine, locking into one's own inner, if you like, connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But that, in a way, I mean, Ayatollah Khamenei has kind of subtly alluded to this, is only part of what the Hajj is about. Yet it's the part of the Hajj which actually has been, for maybe centuries, been propagated as being the only aspect of Hajj, you know, the ritual, religious, devotional aspect. There is another aspect which Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has kind of consistently, it's not just this year, he's consistently reminded people that Hajj also has a social and a political aspect. Hajj is really not only in terms of unity and harmony, which he talks about, something which links the Muslim world to the realities of their time, because unity means not only unity amongst Muslims, it means unity also with humanity on the basis of prophetic moral virtues and ethics. Now, that's a huge aspect of the whole notion of the unity at the Hajj. The Hajj itself, of course, is an array of every kind of ethnicity, every kind of class, or every kind of geographical location living individual. It knows no difference between men and women. It's a real of course, an absolute physical example of the lack of division and the pure coming together of humanity. So in that sense, of course, he's trying to project that a little further and alluding to the situation, particularly of West Asia, but beyond. And what he's hinted very clearly is that there is a wholesale attack on traditional prophetic values, and that would mean across the world. And there are attacks being launched by organized neoliberal, neoconservative institutions and the financiers behind those institutions, and they're destroying the fundamental values of society as we know them, everything from the family through to our governments and our systems and our relationships and even our own perceptions of our own genders and ourselves. You know, these are all things that are under attack. Gender fluidity is a big thing. The whole idea of sexual hypersexuality, if you like, or hypermaterialism, is a thing which specifically the West exports. And he's obviously clearly saying that the Hajj represents an opportunity for us to, A, reject all of that division and all of that materialism. I mean, materialism is okay, but unless it's grounded in spirituality and the good of humanity, it becomes an evil which we're basically being rolled out on a huge scale, where billionaires become more like trillionaires, and the poor become even poorer. And at this stage is where Islam needs to start not just looking at itself as some sort of ritualistic religion which deals with people's devotion and afterlife, but rather it has to come into what it really is, which is a deen, a way of life, a complete way of life. So I think what Ayatollah Khamenei pointed to here is about this kind of miraculous phenomenon of resistance, which is increasingly emerging as the alternative to hypermaterial, secular, neoliberal imperialism.
Master Shajara also joining us from the British capital, London. Mr. Shajara, the leader, he said enemies have long strived to sow division and undermine spirituality among Muslims. Who benefits from these divisions?
Well, colonial power and the arrogance of Western colonial power have always been using divide and rule as a tool to implement their policies all around the world. And now it's no different. The only difference is that now it's very clear Islam is the only major ideology which challenges this colonial abuses around the world, and indeed is being targeted because of that. After the fall of Soviet Union and communism becoming irrelevant to some extent, Islam is the only ideology which is challenging the status quo, and it's being targeted because of that. You'll see the effort that is being put into Islamophobia, demonization of Islam, and using every media and every opportunity to create a Western friendly Islam, an Islam which separates the religion from the politics and the economics and everything else. It's something that, as you know, the West have been involved in for a very long time. A sort of Islam that is compatible with the colonial needs and aspiration. And this we see that. And also, it's not a secret that everyone, all the Muslims, and indeed even those who see themselves as enemies of Islam, agree that for Islam to be successful, you need unity. You need purpose, you need direction. And this is exactly what Ayatollah Khamenei has been urging for a very long time. And, you know, the power will not come to Muslim world by the direction of sitting down having cups of coffee with the U.S. president or sitting down and being abused like the prince did with Trump, or indeed having nuclear weapons like Pakistan has. the reality is that only way that a government will become powerful is by being independent, not allowing itself to be manipulated, to have a direction, the direction of bringing people together, empowering the Muslim community to create a better and juster society, not just for Muslims, but for everyone else. That is the only winning card, and we need to emphasize that. This is what Islam is all about. Islam is not sure. about sort of keeping the hierarchical structure and just putting Muslim on top so they will abuse everybody else. Islam is about removing the oppressors and empowering the oppressed.
Okay. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, you, in our previous question, you mentioned the issue of resistance. Ayatollah Khamenei named Palestine as one of the manifestations of resistance, as it has been able to, quote, bring down the rebellious Zionist regime from its state of aggression. How crucial is the issue of Palestine regarding Muslim nations' unity, and how fundamental is the issue of Palestine when we talk about resistance against oppression?
I think it's absolutely pivotal. Ayatollah Khomeini himself made Al-Quds Day a particular day of remembrance for all of the oppressed of the world, but he utilized Al-Quds and Palestine as the symbol of that aspiration of liberating the oppressed from the oppressors. And he very clearly, you know, Iran and Ayatollah Khamenei have very clearly continued that process. And the results and the fruits of that can actually be seen. You know, he's mentioned Palestine, and it's very true. There were the days when Israel would go raging into Palestinian territories with no worries. They don't do that anymore. They have to use airplanes, bomb a few places, and then stop. They're not able to even trigger their own dome defense systems to prevent missiles and rockets, the most rudimentary rockets, from entering their territories, as we saw in the last conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Now, this is the result, really, of, first of all, Iran's steadfastness, because Iran's advancement in technology, its advancement in scientific fields, its advancement in terms of a resistance economy, in creating a self-reliance in terms of being able to produce its own, its ability to reject the maximum pressure of the United States and the entire West, its ability to reject even the British, the Bank of International Settlements, and to stay out of their grip. All of this is nothing short of a miraculous kind of resistance. And you see, what's really fascinating is that model has then been looked at by many, many movements, but the ones that have manifested in their own way, shape, in different places, are quite important to look at. So the first one of these resistance manifestations you point to straight away is Hezbollah in Lebanon and their protection of the Lebanese independence and sovereignty, and their head-on struggle against the Zionist military and other, invasive, if you like, aggressive actions. They are on the front line and have successfully twice repelled Israeli efforts to invade Lebanon and to occupy it. So that's one model. And that model, mind you, didn't start as a military model. It began really as a social model, a model where the leaders of Hezbollah actually nurtured a social welfare system, hospitals, providing aid, providing people, all sorts of things that they required in their villages that they weren't getting in their townships. And that's what actually Hezbollah is primarily about. Israel, of course, has turned it into also a militarily defensive force because of its belligerence. But move on to, say, someone like Sheikh Zakzaki in Nigeria, another man hugely influenced by the Islamic Revolution and the system of Iran, Velayat-e Faqih, which is specific to the Islamic Republic of Iran. But he has a movement of peace, absolutely peaceful movement in Nigeria, where his people get regularly murdered and killed by the dictatorial Buhari regimes and the murderous tyranny that exists there. Then move on, my point is that yet there, nonetheless, that movement lives and survives and it's growing rapidly. I'll just give one more example. In Iraq today, it wouldn't exist had the model of the Islamic Republic of Iran not been certified and backed up by Ayatollah Sistani, for instance, and the creation of the PMUs, and their repulsion of the proxy agents called ISIS, the proxies of Zionist Western imperialism. So those are just three blatant examples, which you can see. I could go on to Syria. I could talk about many other areas. Yemen itself, of course, is another prime example of how the resistance has taken note of the models of the Islamic Republic of Iran about resistance to this imperial arrogance. And you see in every one of those fields, you will see that the resistance is more than holding its own. And if it wasn't for this huge amount of money and the technical and military, arsenal which these arrogant powers are throwing at these wars, you would see that these people would have been long liberated. But I think that process has certainly begun, and the mindset of Muslims, as Ayatollah Khamenei says, is beginning to change into one of confidence and hope from being one of totally subjugated vassals of the Zionist imperialist empire.
Sure. Master Shajad, Islamic self-awareness has created a wondrous, miraculous phenomenon in the very heart of the Islamic world, and this poses serious problems for the arrogant powers. Those are the words of Ayatollah Khamenei. He called the name of this phenomenon resistance. He added other brilliant examples of Islamic resistance can be clearly seen in Lebanon, Iraq, and elsewhere. What is the main characteristic of this Islamic resistance?
Well, you can't separate Islam from the resistance. I mean, the reality is that Islam, being a political, social, economical, and spiritual...
All right, Mr. Shajad, we're experiencing some technical difficulties. We'll get back to you as soon as that's fixed. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, while we get back to Mr. Shajad, I'd like to bring up another point, and that's a segment of the leader's message focused on Iran as well. He hailed what he called the stability, independence, progress, and honor of the Islamic Republic as a meaningful phenomenon that can attract the thoughts of every conscious Muslim. All of that mentioned, as we know, is happening amidst the U.S. sanctions and its so-called maximum pressure campaign, which makes Iran's advancements and the country's progress even more substantial and more impressive, doesn't it?
I think absolutely. I mean, I often say this. I think it's a miracle that the Islamic Republic of Iran has been able to resist all these economic sanctions and went that path, and the people's sacrifice and the sacrifice of the leadership is something that history will only really fully acknowledge many, many years after this period is over. But it really is the first time that a nation of this kind has been able to resist the arrogant powers kind of prerogatives. You know, when the World Bank and when the American Army and when the Bank of International Settlements and the World Bank and all these other agencies, when they set to work on destroying a nation, they're usually pretty good at it, and they usually bring it to its knees one way or another, economic, military, or otherwise. But according to Ayatollah Khamenei, he says, I mean, I'll quote, the sovereignty of Islam in the legislative and executive branches of governance, reliance on the vote of the people in the country's most important administrative matters, complete political independence, and a refusal to rely on any oppressive powers are among the basic principles in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, that, for me, packs everything in there. First of all, you've got to have a model. When you tell a people, look, you've got to rebel against the system, i.e. the neoliberal Western imperialist system, the first thing people think in their minds is, well, if we rebel, first of all, will we get killed? Will we get, annihilated? The second is, what's the alternative? Well, you know, the Islamic Republic has given an answer to both. First of all, if you're going to rebel against an immoral, corrupt system, then the reality is that God is with you, and Islam tells us very clearly that martyrdom leads to paradise. So this is something which is at the heart of this resistance movement and the heart of Iran's own resistance, particularly. And the other aspect is, when people ask you, okay, what's the alternative to neoliberal capitalism? Well, Iran has genuinely now offered a system which involves the people, which has an oversight from wise basira or insightful jurisprudence and other experts. They've also given a system which actually allows for the morality of the West to be checked, and that system has delivered ultimately under the worst circumstances a set of if you like results, which I can quote. from universities of medical students to the increase in all of that field, the whole expansion of universities in Iran. I can quote the advancement in everything from biomedical developments through to drone and military hardware. And all of them, Iran is becoming one of the most excellent in all these fields. Now, women's advance within the education system, their involvement in the field of work and development of Iran mustn't be ignored. All of these things are just the tip of the iceberg of all the successes that the Islamic Republic of Iran has been able to deliver practically. Now, who's watching? All of these other nations like the Saudis who've been throwing money upon money, they've had zillions of dollars of oil wealth, which they flitted away into real estates in America, created no infrastructures, no industry, created no self-independence, no sovereignty. All they've done is exactly what their Zionist and American
Said Mohsen Abbas. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to jump in there. We've got Mr. Shajada back with us from London, and we're going to put our final question to Mr. Shajada. You can finish where you left off about the previous question about Islamic resistance, but I'm also going to put another question for you, and if you can, give us a brief answer. One of the key points of today's address was the mentioning of the failures of the U.S. and the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The distress and failure of the United States and its criminal accomplice, the usurper regime in the region, can clearly be seen." Are these failures now piling up, and are they becoming more and more evident, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I think the world is awakening to the reality which Islamic Republic, through this revolution, identified. The sort of the Zionists are now exposed, and they're being identified very clearly. And an apartheid state has got certain legal connotation. It has to be challenged by all nations, and it cannot be revived. It has to be removed. It cannot be fixed, and it cannot be changed. It really has to be removed, like it did when South Africa got rid of the apartheid system, and then people could begin, whites and black, living together in harmony. Same thing has to happen in occupied Palestine. And so the people of the region and in the occupied territories could begin putting their lives back together.
Sure.
U.S. is policy is bankrupt. Look what is happening in Ukraine. Look
thank
what
you,
is happening.
Thank you, Mr. Shajada. Yeah, we're fresh out of time for this segment of the program. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, joining us from the British capital, London. And thanks to Islamic Human Rights from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajada, also joining us from the British capital. A special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
Hereby congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. A happy Eid al-Adha to all our listeners.
In the limelight.
As the Israeli regime continues to attack and harm Palestinians, European Union elites are publicly signaling their full support. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ali Abu Nima, writer. This article is published under the heading, EU Punishes Palestinian Cancer Patients to Police Israeli Regime. Here's the story. The European Union is making Palestinian cancer patients suffer as part of a campaign to appease the Israeli lobby in Brussels. It is doing so by withholding some $230 million in funding that was already committed to support Palestinians living under Israeli regime military occupation. The payment has been delayed since last year, as the European Union continues to condition the release of the money on specific changes to Palestinian school textbooks, the Norwegian Refugee Council stated recently. The aid suspension, reminiscent of the cuts imposed by U.S. President Donald Trump after he took office in 2017, is crippling critical sectors and services, including healthcare in occupied East Al-Quds, with dire consequences for patients needing treatment at hospitals, the charity added. These restrictions punish terminally ill patients who cannot get life-saving medicine and force children to go hungry when parents cannot afford to buy food, said Jan Egeland, the Norwegian Refugee Council's Secretary General, adding, Palestinians are paying the cruelest price for political decisions made in Brussels. As a result, at least 500 newly diagnosed cancer patients have been unable to access life-saving treatments at occupied East Al-Quds Augusta Victoria Hospital. Others are experiencing severe delays in receiving critical treatment. Those political decisions appear largely to be the result of a campaign waged by Olivier Varhaely, a senior official in the European Commission, the EU's executive body. Varhaely has been promoting Israeli lobby lies that Palestinian textbooks contain anti-Semitism and glorify terrorism. The lies about Palestinian textbooks are part of a long-running disinformation campaign by the Zionist regime and its lobby groups. The campaign aims to promote the ludicrous claim that Palestinians are hostile to Israel not because it has brutally violated their most fundamental rights for decades, but because they are being brainwashed to hate Jews in their classrooms. Although the campaign took off in the United States more than two decades ago, it has more recently been taken up by pro-Israel European far right. Notably, Varhaely was nominated to his post by Viktor Orban, Prime Minister of his native Hungary. Orban has circulated anti-Semitic tropes in election campaigns and conferred hero status on a Nazi collaborator. Yet, as the electronic entephaza David Cronin has noted, Varhaely has yet to denounce those manifestations of genuine anti-Jewish bigotry. Despite Varhaely's claims being false, he is succeeding in what is perhaps one of his unstated goals, making the most vulnerable Palestinians suffer and maybe even die. As the Zionist regime continues to attack and harm Palestinians, European Union elites are publicly signaling their full support. Earlier this week, Roberto Metsola, the president of the European Parliament, went on a high-profile junket to Israel, where she met the president, prime minister, and foreign minister. Metsola offered not a word of criticism for the Zionist regime's brutal rule over millions of Palestinians, which Palestinian, Zionist, and international human rights groups have characterized as apartheid, one of the most heinous crimes against humanity enumerated in the International Criminal Court's founding Rome Statute. Instead, Metsola addressed the Zionist regime's parliament, praising it as a house of democracy. Ignoring the Zionist regime's escalating crimes against the Palestinian people, including its recent killing and subsequent cover-up of Al Jazeera correspondent Shirin Abu Aghla, Metsola urged that the partnership between EU and Israel should be further strengthened. While pandering to the Zionist regime and complicity with its crimes is the norm for European Union leaders, Metsola's visit was even more than usually abject. She went ahead with it even after the Zionist regime denied entry to a delegation led by Manuel Pineda, one of her European Parliament colleagues. The mission was partly in response to the killing of Al Jazeera correspondent Shirin Abu Aghla. Pineda is the president of Parliament's delegation for EU-Palestine relations and thus plays an essential role in monitoring the use of European Union funding and the actions of the bloc's officials on the ground. Metsola did not show solidarity with her colleagues or demand that the Zionist regime respect the European Parliament by cancelling her visit. Instead, she issued a tweet expressing regret at Pineda's exclusion and claiming she would raise the issue directly with authorities concerned. The fabricated regime of Israel will almost certainly perceive these soft words, followed by Metsola's lavish and unconditional praise for the apartheid regime as acquiescence and even a green light to continue excluding anyone it considers insufficiently subservient. It is unlikely coincidental that Pineda is currently the target of a character assassination campaign by the Israeli regime lobby. Recently, the Simon Wiesenthal Center published an open letter to Ursula von der Leyen, the unelected president of the European Commission, demanding that the popularly elected Pineda must be expelled from the European Parliament on the basis that he is a spokesman for terrorists. The Israeli regime lobby group laundry list of grievances against Pineda includes that he joined a 2011 flotilla to Gaza aiming to break Israeli regime's brutal blockade on the territory, and that he associates with members of Palestinian and Lebanese political groupings and resistance groups, that the Zionist regime and its European allies have arbitrarily designated as terrorists. The anti-Palestinian group even repeats unsubstantiated smears that Pineda's left-wing party, Podemos, a member of Spain's governing coalition, was allegedly financed by some countries. These claims emerged in 2016, a part of what one Podemos voter termed a dirty campaign by Spain's then right-wing government. Yet they are exactly the kind of smears and the Zionist regimes and its lobby regularly use against anyone who dares to criticize them or stand with Palestinians. Leading Palestinian human rights organizations sent an open letter to European Parliament President Roberta Metsola. They denounced her decision to visit the occupied territories even after authorities there barred the delegation led by Pineda, with whom they were due to meet. They also condemned her offer of stronger ties with the Zionist regime, while failing even to mention the killing of Abu Aghla, as well as the Zionist regime's accelerating expulsions of Palestinian villagers in Masafer Yatta area of the West Bank. The groups told Metsola that you have failed to fulfill your responsibility under international law and make yourself complicit in the institutionalized domination and systematic oppression of the Palestinian people. Some of the groups that wrote to Metsola are among the six baselessly designated by the fabricated regime of Israel as terrorist organizations last year in an effort to stymie and discredit their work documenting its crimes. The EU, which has funded several of those groups, has allowed the fake regime of Israel to get away with the smearing. Now the EU is allowing the Zionist regime to do the same to its elected representatives. Brussels will do whatever it takes to serve and appease the fake regime of Israel and its lobby, even if That means deliberately and knowingly inflicting additional suffering on Palestinian cancer patients.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.